Jay-Z ballot breakdown.
Ballot breakdown.
Broomhead breaks down who and what are on your ballot. Jay-Z ballot breakdown.
All right, as we dive into this, the topic is going to continue for quite a while until it's resolved in the Arizona State Legislature. It's become a national and international story, and it's the topic of the 1864 law. And, you know, I know that there are some qualifications and updates, and it happened in 1973 in this, but in essence, this law was written in 1864. It is a bad look for Arizona. And again, I don't want anybody to question my pro-life credentials because I'm critical that we've reverted back to a law in territorial days. It doesn't look good. We can talk about it from multiple places, and we're going to as it pertains to the election. And that's what we're going to do right now. I want you to hear a little bit of this. This is a Democratic representative, Oscar De Los Santos, yesterday talking about the problem with this law that goes back, reverts back, was written in 1864.
This issue is very simple. Do we support or do we oppose an 1864 territorial abortion ban that includes no exceptions for rape, no exceptions for incest?
And that is the way it's being crafted. I will tell you, I see it differently than the people that are in favor of what's going to be on the ballot. I am someone that is pro-life. I want you to hear, this is Ben Toma, who is the Arizona Speaker of the House, that talked about his belief in abortion.
And I would ask everyone in this chamber to respect the fact that some of us believe that abortion is, in fact, the murder of children.
And I don't think he's wrong. This is the problem with this. I am respectful in my tone, and not everybody is on either side of this conversation because it's such a passionate issue. I know it gets emotional, but there has got to be mutual respect in every conversation. If you want me, and I'm doing this anyway, it's not an either or with me. It's just how it is with me. But if you want pro-life people to respect your opinion, you have to respect theirs. Don't insult people like me and like Speaker Toma and say, we want to restrict your body and what you can do with your body. I've been sarcastic in speaking on this topic and say, I don't care what you do with your body. Tattoo it, pierce it, cut it off for all I care. I don't care what you do with your body. It's up to you. It's none of my business. And I'm not judgmental about it. I don't judge people on their appearance, piercings, tattoos, hair color. I don't judge at all. I learned a long time ago not to prejudge people based on appearance. So I sincerely mean it when I say that. I don't care what you do with your body. But like the speaker just explained, some of us believe it's a human life and that it deserves to be protected. That's why we're passionate in our opposition to abortion. That being said, this is the part of it where we have to face facts, and so does the speaker. And I want you to listen when he talks about this. He said he's about the public. When he talks about not rushing this, I want you to hear what he said about not rushing this vote.
The last thing we should be doing today is rushing a bill through the legislative process to repeal a law that has been enacted and reaffirmed by the legislature several times.
So he's not wrong. I know it's passionate. If I were a pro-choice woman, which I am exactly the opposite, but if I were a pro-choice woman, I would be very emotional about this. I would be very angry about this. And there are people that I admire and I care about deeply that are pro-choice individuals and pro-choice women especially. And I absolutely respect their passion on the issue, their concern for the issue. I understand all of it. I really do. I don't agree with it. But that doesn't mean that I can't be sensitive and that I can't be respectful of their position. But I have an expectation that you're going to respect mine as well. These are where these conversations need to be had, because this is how it ends, in my opinion. I realize, hearing now with the outcry of people in Arizona, that the voices that say it should be legal and accessible to women are much larger than we anticipated they were going to be. There are many people that have said for a very long time, women, I would never have an abortion. I wouldn't recommend somebody I love have an abortion, my daughter, my sister, whatever. But I think it should be available in certain circumstances for women as an option. And that those voices are going to win out. I believe those voices outnumber voices like mine. That doesn't mean my fight is over. I will still talk to anybody that will have the conversation with me about why I think it's wrong. And that there are options out there, including adoption, And you can go to places like Choices Pregnancy Centers. And I would try to, as best I can, if somebody asked my opinion and advice, to give them my opinion and my advice. I also think that what we are dealing with in this law, and I believe the state legislature understands this, is that the Republicans and the legislature, forget losing elections. The elections part of this, by the time November comes, this is going to have calmed down, especially when there are solutions available and there's a ballot initiative available. There are people that are one-issue voters. There are pro-life people that's the only issue that matters to them, and it doesn't matter what your qualifications are. I'm pro-life. When it comes to primary elections, it is a deal breaker for me. If you're a presidential candidate, you're a Republican candidate, and I'm choosing you in a primary, or you're one of my choices in a primary, and you're pro-choice, you're not my person. That's it. You're not my person. But in a general election, when I've got a pro-choice candidate that's Republican and a pro-choice candidate that's Democrat, I'm usually going to, and not always, but I will usually, I lean right. I'm a Republican voter. If the only difference between you, or I shouldn't say that, if there are many differences between you, but the only similarity is that you're both pro-choice, I'm going to go with the one that leans with my political leanings. And there are people that are pro-choice or pro-life that are not that way. Same with pro-choice. One-issue vote. That it doesn't matter what else you stand for. There are people, and they have a right to do that. But we have got to have cooler heads that prevail on this. And how this is going to affect the election? Well, this is now become, if you've not seen the ads yet, the television ads are beginning to run. President Biden, a couple of weeks ago, began running an ad talking about his age. And at the end of the ad, he cracks a joke and they laugh a little bit. But he talks about running the country and he's been able to get things done and what you'd expect in a campaign ad. Just this week, the Biden campaign began running a television ad in Arizona about being pro-choice and how you're losing your rights under Donald Trump and what rights will you lose next if he's in power. And this is exactly what they should be doing when running this campaign. They are going to make this the Democrat, and they should. I mean, this is part of their issue now. This is where they believe they can win. They're not going to win on the economy. They're certainly not going to win on the border in Arizona. So this is going to be the issue if they can keep this at the top of the list. But in the end, what are we going to end up with? When it comes to the elections, when it comes to the November ballot, what will we end up with? We're not going to have an 1864 law. It's not going to happen. It is not going to remain the way that it is. To all of the people out there, respectfully, that are pro-life, that believe that this law is going to be the law of the land, and come November, voters are not going to vote for a ballot initiative that goes way beyond Roe v. Wade and far as what it technically what it says and how it's going to alter the Constitution. I think you're wrong. I don't think the voters are going to vote for that. I would rather have that than the 1864 law than the expansion of access to abortion. Personally, that's my choice as a voter. But I don't believe that's what's going to happen. So there's going to have to be a compromise. The 15-week compromise seemed to be what the majority of Arizona voters seemed was reasonable. Even people that said, I would never do it myself nor recommend it to someone I care about, but I think it should be accessible. So do you fight to get what you think you can, or do you stand your ground and say, this is the way it should be? It's a great question. All right, what we're going to do coming up in a moment is we're going to talk about capital punishment, because there is a new case before the Supreme Court that involves Arizona. We'll get to that coming up here in just a moment.
Strong values and strong opinions. The Mike Broomhead Show. KTAR News, 92.3 FM and the KTAR News app.
All right, Alanis Morissette, Joan Jett, and the Blackhearts are headed to Talking Stick Resort Amphitheater June 9th for the Triple Moon Tour. Limited tickets are still available, but if you go over to the contest page at KTAR.com, you can get a chance to win a pair of tickets. This is a topic I don't talk about a lot, but it's one that I think is very important, and it's about capital punishment. I'm not pro-capital punishment, and I'm not anti-capital punishment. I am not celebrating taking a life. I will tell you, I've watched people celebrate it, and I understand it to a certain extent. I was a very small boy when Ted Bundy was executed in Florida. This was a guy that was murdering and mutilating women and doing, I don't want to get into all of the details of what he did across the country. and he did it at Florida State University with nursing students, and he was a murderous human being and a serial killer, and he died in the electric chair in Florida, and they celebrated it, and they were singing outside of the prison, and I remember all that as a child. Arizona has capital punishment, and the reason why it frustrates me is this. If we are going to commit, in my opinion, if we're going to commit to saying an eye for an eye, that if as a society we're going to say, if you take a life, you forfeit yours. If you commit a heinous crime and the people of Arizona feel that your crime is so heinous and we can prove that you did it, that you are forfeiting your life, then we have to commit to that. And I'm not talking about sensationalizing, and I'm not talking about brutalizing anyone, but we shouldn't be waiting 20 years, 25 years to do it. Not because of the perpetrator, but because of the survivors of the victim. Every time there's a hearing, every time there is a new proceeding, every time there is a new motion that is requested, the family's wounds are reopened. And here's why I bring this up. Arizona state officials have told the United States Supreme Court yesterday that a lower court gave too much weight to mitigating factors when it ordered a new sentencing for Danny Lee Jones in a pair of brutal murders in 1992. 1992 is when this guy committed these murders. There's no doubt he did it. There's no question. No one's questioning, not even his defense team, that he did it. And it included the strangulation of a seven-year-old little girl. There's nothing more heinous, is there? But the defense team, and this is, I want to read this quote. You know, brutal crimes here. We acknowledge that. But there's a lot of mitigation. This is a lawyer. Long-standing childhood trauma, a lot of head injuries, and more that were not introduced until after Jones was convicted and sentenced. In our view, the aggravating evidence is so compelling, and the mitigating evidence that was developed in the federal evidentiary hearing is so slight, is what the state of Arizona is saying. This has been going on since 1992, over 30 years. And why, as citizens of Arizona, are we doing it this way? For the families of the survivors? I mean, I'm the survivors of this, the families of the people killed. We are doing things, and what we do with this, what we've done with capital punishment, is we try to mitigate our guilt for taking a life. So what we've done is we have gone from firing squads to gas chambers to from the gallows to lethal injection, and now there's questions about lethal injection. Is it not pain-free? And to the victim's family, sometimes they think, what do you mean pain free? There was none of this for our. I'll tell you how dumb we are. And I'm not trying to be morbid, but this is how dumb we are on this issue. That when they strap somebody to the table to put the needle in their arm for lethal injection, they use an alcohol swab on the injection site. Why? That prevents infection. You're going to be dead in 10 minutes. But that's what we do. We give people a last meal. They get the meal of their choosing. We're doing that not for them. They're going to be dead in 24 hours. We do that because we feel guilty, because we know we're taking a life. Well, if we feel that guilty, let's just lock them up for the rest of their life. Let's lock them away. Let's spare the expense. If we're going to spend the money to house somebody, to warehouse an inmate for 30 something years, why then go through all of the expense of capital punishment? I'm not trying to be morbid, and I'm not trying to be insensitive. But if we are going to, if we know, if there's an eyewitness to it, if you look at the Tsarnaev brothers. I just watched the documentary of the Boston Marathon bombing, and the surviving brother, Jokar, I think is his first name, Tsarnaev. He is in prison and he's fighting over his commissary money. There's like $3,000 that was in his commissary and he believes he should be able to keep the money. He's on death row. We know he did it. There were eyewitnesses. There's video. There was him running over his own brother. We know he did it. Why would he sit on death row for all of these years? if that's the route, if that's what this country says, this is how we are handling a case that involves heinous crimes like this. You indiscriminately put pressure cooker bombs at the Boston Marathon that mauled and murdered children and adults that were out at the Boston Marathon. For that, you forfeit your life. What are we waiting for? Why are we forcing the victims' families and the victims that survived to go through all the court proceedings and all of the other things that go with it? And if we say to ourselves, well, then we're not going to do capital punishment, let's spare the expense of all the lawyers for 30 years and let's warehouse them, lock them up, and throw away the key. I'm not a heartless person. You know, I am someone that believes that people are redeemable. I believe in redemption. I believe in second chances. But if we have crimes that we say are so heinous that you're going to forfeit either your life or you're going to freedom for the rest of your life, then we've got to get on with it. And we've got to get on with it for the sake of the victims' families, not for the sake of the convicted killers. These stories frustrate me, man. A guy strangled a 7-year-old girl. And they're not arguing whether or not he did it. And yet this is what continues. All right. In a moment, two or three boomers don't have nearly enough money. Two out of three have nearly enough money saved.
Strong values and strong opinions. The Mike Broomhead Show. KTAR News, 92.3 FM and the KTAR News app.
We can dance if we want to. We can leave your friends behind. Because your friends don't dance. And if they don't dance, well, they're no friends of mine. I say, we can go where we want to. A place where they will never find.
Okay.
And we can act like we come from out of this world. Leave the real
I can feel the members only jacket I'm wearing right now. I can... The parachute pants and the high top sneakers. Did you guys wear painter hats? Was that a thing here? You know what a painter hat is, Julia? No, you're too young. Jeff, do you know what a painter's hat is?
I know what it is, but I didn't wear it.
You didn't?
No.
So, Julia, let me explain how dumb your parents were, okay? Let me explain to you how dumb we were in your parents' age. Are you ready? We used to go to the paint store because when you would go to a paint store and you'd buy paint, they would give you these ridiculous paper hats.
Paper hats?
Hats made out of really thin material, and you'd wear them while you were painting so you didn't get paint in your hair.
That was nice.
And they would have like the name of the company on them. They were dirt cheap. They were made out of like, it was like a paper bib for your head. We would go to the paint store and get them and wear them to school.
Why?
I don't know. It's because everybody else was wearing them.
Did you paint on them?
No!
Did you buy them at Chess King?
But that was what was dumb about us is we were so dumb that eventually the paint stores caught on that, hey, you know what? They'd pay for these. And we'd pay like 50 cents for a hat or something. And they'd wear out in a day and a half because they were made of paper.
You wouldn't decorate your painter's hat? That seems like a missed opportunity.
Who would? But it would say Sherwin Williams on it. You'd wear it to school.
And people would ask, who does he play for?
Yes.
That is a great marketing tactic.
It was. Anyway, so, all right. Enough down memory lane with the safety dance. We were just talking about, and I'm going to continue this. We talked earlier, baby boomers and not enough of us. And I guess I'm kind of at the tail end of the boomers, but the baby boomers that are going to be 65 this year, 2/3 of them do not have enough money set aside to retire. That's a serious, when you're 65 years old, and this is what you learn when you get older, anybody out there younger that's listening, and I'm talking about even in your 30s. When you get to be 57, like I'll be this year, you realize you're closer to the end than the beginning, that you still have time to do things, but you're running out of time to make up for your mistakes. You always can when you're younger. You've got plenty of time. That's what they tell you when you invest money in a retirement account when you're young. Put it away. Don't look at it. That kind of stuff. Well, I don't believe that's true. You should be looking at it, and it should be working hard for you all the time. But you realize when you get older that you've got less time to fix stuff. I'm not a morbid thinker, but now here's the other side of this, and I talked about this earlier today. Experts offer financial planning tips for college graduates. College grads entering the workforce should build emergency savings while starting their investing for retirement. So you're talking about in your early to mid-20s. This is the one thing I would say to you when I'm looking at the overall economy, not just you personally, not you as an individual, but our overall economy as we talk about it every day in home ownership. Younger or old people are not able to buy homes at a younger age anymore. It's taking people late in their 20s into their 30s before they can save enough money for a down payment on a home. That is going to be detrimental to the economy in 20 years. When you have people that are now 65 years old, huge numbers of people, we are living longer, that will be entering the world where they'll be receiving Social Security benefits, but they don't have enough money set aside to retire and live comfortably, which means they're working longer. That's detrimental to the overall economy. We have got to be talking to younger people about financial stability for themselves, but what that does to the overall economy as a whole. When you have more and more people that are financially stable throughout life, if you can, that's why I am so big on the idea of home ownership. And I know that I'm not a financial advisor, but I'm talking about financial stability. I'm not talking about growth and comfort, but the stability that comes from the equity you can get in a home. It isn't the save all to everything, but it is something that is great. When you have a home and in 10 years, you are making your mortgage payment every month like you would your rent or anything else. And in 10 years, you realize, hey, you know, the house next door sold and we have got $150,000 in equity in our home. Our mortgage is this amount. Let's say it's $1,500. And they're going to be paying $2,600 a month in their mortgage. Our household bills have not really, you know, we're making more money. We've grown in our career, so our mortgage is not a burden to us as much as it was at the beginning. And look at the equity we have in our home. That lends itself to financial stability. The younger we can get people into the housing market, the younger we can get people financially stable so that when you're 30 years old, you've been saving money for 5 or 6 years in a retirement account. You're dealing with a financial planner and someone that does this for a living. By the time you get into your 50s, you're now preparing for retirement. You're not at the time figuring out how you're going to set enough money aside to retire. And I look at this and I think these numbers, I think we owe it to younger people. You owe it to your grandkids. You owe it to, if you have an opportunity to speak in front of young people in high school, that we should be telling young people, listen, life is tough and it's not easy to make a living. We can gripe about it. We can go out and say it's not fair that houses are this expensive. And all of that may be true, but we all know life isn't fair. Here's the reality, high school kid. If you want a life where you own a home, if your goal is to have a career and a family, and you want to be able to do for your children what your parents couldn't do for you, or maybe what your parents did do for you, you are going to have to make this much money. This is the money you're going to make to have that life. Here are the career paths. Here's the college path. Here's the trade path. But you got to pick something at a younger age and be prepared to work your butt off and be disciplined. If you do that, you can have that life you want. Let's teach them that lesson. We can talk about the unfairness, but let's teach them the realities. I think that's part of it. We're going to go back to the border comment or the border topic. We talked about a man on the terror watch list who was dropped from the program that monitors migrants. But what we ought to be talking about is the national security risk at the southern border. And has the U.S. forgotten about what terrorist attacks are like? We'll get to that next.
Strong values and strong opinions. The Mike Broomhead Show. KTAR News, 92.3 FM and the KTAR News app.
Hey, thanks for being here. Appreciate you spending some time. Final hour of the show right around the corner. We opened with this on the border issue. We continue to talk about the national security implications of a lack of border security. It makes perfect sense to everyone. We've got the world in upheaval. We talk about the Middle East and what's going on there, the threats being made by the Iranians. We have seen lone wolf terrorism and how it rears its ugly head and what can happen. We've had it happen in this country from time to time, and now as more unrest is happening. We said after 9/11, never again, never forget, and it seems like we've forgotten. I firmly believe the vast majority of people that are crossing our border illegally are coming here for the right reasons. They're doing it the wrong way. I will tell you, it's a silly analogy, but it fits. I would say that when somebody sneaks into Disney World or Disneyland, they're not there to do damage, but they're still sneaking in without paying. You can't jump the line. But we We have a responsibility. I'm going to answer part of that criticism. We have a responsibility as Americans to ourselves to have a better immigration system. I believe that to be true. We are doing a disservice to the people that are trying to do it the right way by making them wait exorbitant amounts of time to come here. And it's an even bigger slap in their face when they're doing it the right way, when they figure out that the people that are doing it the wrong way are having an easier time getting here and staying here. It's costing thousands of dollars to pay the cartels to come here. It costs thousands of dollars to come here legally, but they're getting here faster and they're able to stay. It's unfortunate. When you look at the national security risks of terrorism, I don't ever want to sit here and say, I told you so. I don't ever want to say we knew this was coming. I would imagine that the people that are in charge of national security and you know, the people, I don't know if any of them are listening, that are with the Joint Terrorism Task Force, the men and women that live in our community, and their job is to oversee threats within the state of Arizona, and they have them all over the country. Their job is to assess and keep a lid on the terrorist threats in our own country, in our own state. I would imagine that that job has become exceedingly more difficult with the numbers of people that are here, just by percentages. And we don't seem to be doing anything about it. We are not. I use the analogy of the squatters in homes. We saw this happen fairly quickly as squatters around this country were finding loopholes in American laws, and they were abusing landlord-tenant laws in order to squat in somebody else's property that they weren't entitled to and that they weren't paying for. So state legislatures and city councils across this country have been rewriting their laws and fixing loopholes so that squatters can't take advantage. You still want to protect the tenant. Just like we still want to protect the immigrant. We still want an immigrant to this country to have access to the greatest country in the world. I want that, and I think most of you want that. But when we see a loophole that's been kicked wide open and they're taking advantage of our asylum laws, it's beholden on us to close those loopholes. When the president of the United States, by virtue of the executive privilege with executive powers and executive orders, can do things about policy to close things down until the legislature makes changes to the law, that's the way we're supposed to work. I think everybody would agree with that. You want to hold the Congress accountable? So do I. I think there should be better legislation. But the president can do things in the meantime. And the president reversed a lot of executive orders. If the president wanted to shut down the border, he could. And he could also then say, now here is what I'm doing with executive privilege. I am signing an executive order, and these are the policy changes we're making on enforcement, and we are sending a clear message to the rest of the world. If you try to enter this country illegally, you are going to be vetted a lot more stringently, a lot more strict requirements to come in to be in line for asylum. If you come across the border with a fake or what is deemed to be an illegitimate asylum claim, you're going to be sent back across the border, and you are not going to have an opportunity to come back again for a period of 12 to 18 to 24 months. And we are going to up our border security to the point, I don't care if we have to call up the National Guard, we are going to secure our border to the point that you're not going to sneak back in. And if you get caught sneaking into this country, you're not going to be able to apply for a very long period of time for legal entry into the U.S. If the president did that, and then he said, now I'm putting it on the legislature, get us the money, then get us the tools necessary for real border security and a revamping and modernization of our immigration system. So the good people that are trying to do it the right way are not waiting extended periods of time to get to the United States or bring their loved ones to the United States. You do that, you're a hero to the country. And that is not the system we have. In the meantime, the terror threat is real. I just hope it's never realized. The reason why it's not been realized is not because the threats in our country don't exist. It's because the men and women that protect us in the Joint Terrorism Task Forces and the members of our government working hand in hand federally and locally have been able to keep a lid on it. And we just got to stay diligent. We have to stay diligent. Just after 11 o'clock, we are going to speak with Brian Mueller. He is the president of Grand Canyon University. As the Department of Education head said at a congressional hearing that they want to shut down GCU, that they are going after them and they are going to send a message. You're going to hear a response from the president of Grand Canyon University and their response to the charges. That's coming up next.